Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Deng Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Friday, July 13th, 2018. The UN Security Council votes to impose an arms embargo on South Sudan.
Today, this council gives a clear signal that the international community no longer tolerates the gross human rights violations in South Sudan.
And women's groups in Juba protest the continuing war.
It is unacceptable for women, children, the elderly, the disabled, and indeed all South Sudan to continue bearing the burden and consequences of this conflict.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The UN Security Council adopted a U.S.-drafted resolution to impose an arms embargo on South Sudan until May 2019. The resolution includes a travel ban and an asset freeze on South Sudanese military officials Malek Ruben Riak and Paul Malanga Wan, both of whom are listed as expanding or extending the conflict or threatening the peace of South Sudan. The resolution passed with 9 yes votes. There were 6 abstentions, including Ethiopia, Russia, and China. South Sudan's ambassador to the UN, Akwe Bonamalwal, urged council members to vote against the measure, saying it would deter progress made by IGAD and the region.
But to pass a resolution at the time when the peace process is making advances, positive advances, and you pass such a resolution, which will actually now will tilt the balance for those parties that are negotiating. The opposition will think the Security Council is on their side, so why should they really continue to negotiate peace? That's why this resolution is unfortunate.
IGAD has led high-level forum talks to revitalize the 2015 peace deal, which have so far failed to bring about a comprehensive peace agreement between the warring parties. Bona called the resolution a slap in the face to IGAD member states and the African Union, who are trying to mediate a peace deal. Carol van Oosterum, representative of the Netherlands on the Security Council who voted in favor of the embargo, praised today's vote.
Today, this council gives a clear signal that the international community no longer tolerates the gross human rights violations in South Sudan. And it underscores the need to achieve tangible results in the ongoing political negotiations. The Security Council will continue to monitor the situation in South Sudan and stands ready to act further if necessary.
Ethiopian Ambassador Takeda Alemu abstained from voting and registered his frustration on the resolution to the Security Council members.
A divided council on this issue, we all know, will not be helpful to the peace process because it will send the wrong message to the parties, the result of which will be loss of the council, of its credibility, and thus leverage. That is what we have been trying to avoid, but to no avail.
That was Ethiopian Ambassador Takeda Alemu speaking to the UN Security Council a few hours ago. One South Sudan researcher says adopting the resolution is an indication of fatigue on South Sudan and of the growing pessimism that the country's leaders can actually end the conflict. Casey Copeland, a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group, says the move in the Security Council is significant.
Significant for a number of reasons. Number one, it's quite significant showing of where USUN and Ambassador Nikki Haley is willing to go on the South Sudan issue, pushing for an arms embargo and actively lobbying to secure votes and eventually today succeeding where the Obama administration was unable to the last time the U.S. tried back in 2016. What it means on the ground is going to be, it's not clear yet, depends on whether it's enforced and monitored, whether it actually stops the flow of weapons in, and then what the effect of that is. Certainly, the country's awash in weapons already, so whether it changes the nature of the conflict overnight, I think, isn't something that that we should necessarily expect to see. And then finally, it was a big warning, I think, to the South Sudanese government that that the U.S. is serious and it's not not going to accept sort of half measures, a ceasefire that's signed and not implemented in making decisions about how to pursue punitive action in the Security Council.
What exactly was passed today? What is in today's resolution that was adopted?
So there were two or three interesting things. The first is the arms embargo, which will be enforced until May of next year, at which point the council will vote on it again. The second is individual sanctions on two generals, neither one of which are actively serving in the government. One is former chief of staff, General Malong, who's now leading a rebel movement. And the other is General Malik Rubin, who was an SPLA general, well, still is, but not in active service any longer. So the list had previously included several government ministers, but those individuals were negotiated out. So what we wind up with is an interesting set of two individuals who aren't responsible for violating the most recent permanent ceasefire, but their names were the ones that were eventually settled on. And then we also saw some interesting conversations and ultimately that made into the resolution that sexual and gender-based violence are now a cause, a standalone cause for individuals to be listed for sanctions.
What are the immediate and long-term consequences of this move, and what does it mean to the ongoing talks between Kiir and Machar?
So the talks between Kiir and Machar right now in Sudan are primarily motivated by economic incentives. There's an idea that a peace agreement, that if it can be made, it can be to everyone's benefit. A sort of big tent, broad-based power-sharing government can come back into force, and with additional security, oil production can increase, and then there will be more money to go around. So to some extent, that wasn't based on Security Council action. So the threat isn't necessarily what drove that. On the other hand, the talks are entering a tricky phase. We're seeing some pretty significant disputes between the parties over how they want to move forward. And what we see is that the council now doesn't have the leverage of an arms embargo to threaten with. It does still have the leverage of additional individual sanctions, which it could put forward if it believes that certain individuals are responsible for undermining efforts to reach an agreement. That said, the one thing that we don't know yet is how the government in South Sudan is going to respond to this, as they've advocated actively against this for many years.
Even during the Security Council meeting today, the South Sudan ambassador said that this will send a signal to the rebels that the Security Council is on their side. Does this, in fact, change the calculations of the war?
In many ways, rebel groups who have for years now struggled to get weapons themselves have advocated for an arms embargo. They feel it will level the playing field. So in many respects, I think we know that rebel leaders are celebrating this move today. That said, it doesn't make it any easier for them to get any weapons either. So the idea is whether it's simply a gradual wearing down of the capability of the South Sudanese government. Does it lead rebel leaders to think that in their calculations, if they waited out a few more years, eventually the government will be weak enough that they could get better terms? Maybe. But I think alone, that's probably not that's not the only thing that's going to factor into people's decision making.
An arms embargo on South Sudan has been introduced in the Security Council multiple times, even including under the Obama administration. What do you think it is about this particular moment that allowed it to go through the council?
There's a fatigue on South Sudan. People are deeply pessimistic. I think IGAD, the high-level forum, was really going nowhere, but IGAD kept presenting it as a viable option. And so now when we actually have a peace process, which is more viable, there's skepticism from council members that it's actually going to lead to a peace agreement. The conflict has been going on for so long that people see an arms embargo, for example, the United Kingdom, sees it as much more of a humanitarian tool than as a political measure. And finally, Ambassador Nikki Haley did an extensive amount of personal advocacy and lobbying to countries to ensure that she had those 9 votes when she went in the room today. Not something that we never saw the Obama administration do.
That was Casey Copeland, senior analyst at the International Crisis Group, speaking to me earlier today from Washington, D.C. Various South Sudanese women's groups organized a peaceful demonstration on the streets of Juba to protest the continued fighting in parts of the country. One group says South Sudanese women and children have been bearing the brunt of the nearly five-year conflict. From Juba, Manyang David Mayar has more for VOA.
Singing and chanting slogans of peace, more than 500 women took part in the protest. Some carried banners reading, "Let South Sudan resurrect with peace." Some of the protesters say the conflict has devastated the country and women suffer disproportionately more because of the ongoing violence. Siama Wani, speaking in Arabic, is one of them.
This war has really affected us very much in our communities and families. I want the leaders to bring us peace that is not only on paper. It should be a true, genuine peace so that women stay happy and that we should be free from hunger and violence. I pray that this will be the end of war in South Sudan.
Betty Sunday is the chairperson of the Women's Monthly Forum, a group that helped organize the march.
Kids are not going to schools, and some of us remain widows because we lost our husbands, we lost our sons. It's becoming really a traumatic country. And as women, what we wanted to know is that, or what we wanted to say today is that let our leaders, really they have to compromise to sign peace agreement in order to end the end suffering of the people of South Sudan. People are suffering. We don't want to say it's a refugees. We were born in another country. We were born in war. We grew up in war. We got married in war. And we give birth to our children in war. And we don't want it to continue.
Last month, President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar signed a permanent ceasefire and a security arrangement agreement in Khartoum. The parties continue to discuss the contentious issues of power sharing and governance in the Sudanese capital. The women's group say they appreciate efforts by the warring parties who signed the permanent ceasefire, but they say they are disappointed by the reports of continued human rights violations committed against women and children. Mary Justo is the information officer for the Women's Monthly Forum.
It is unacceptable for women, children, the elderly, the disabled, and indeed all South Sudan to continue bearing the burden and consequences of this conflict, including impunity, rape, severe hunger, displacement, and almost complete lack of social services at the hands of the parties to the conflict.
Earlier this week, the United Nations Human Rights Monitors released a report accusing the South Sudan Army of killing 332 civilians, raping 120 women and girls, and abducting 130 others between April and May. The report also accused government troops of burning villages and looting property in Mayendit and Leer counties of southern Liech State. The South Sudan military spokesman, Brigadier General Lurwai Kong, denied the accusations. But Justo says women know the truth and are demanding a public apology from the warring parties.
We, the members of Women Monthly Forum on the Peace Process, urge the leaders to apologize to the people of South Sudan, especially women, youth and girls, and all victims of human rights violation for the atrocities and abuses being consciously and widely committed against them.
The women urged the international community to hold perpetrators accountable for atrocities committed during the conflict and called on IGAD countries mediating the talks to remain impartial and avoid what the women leaders call geopolitical interest. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The talks in Khartoum have been extended. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Is it important for you to follow the news in other countries?
Of course, yes. It is important. That's how I get informed, actually. Because that's how I get informed and knowing what is going on around the world.
It's better to know what's going on in the world, what's going on in other countries, so that we'll be updated at times. Yes, it helps me to know what other countries are facing and how to help my country to develop the country, because there are some instances that happen in other countries that I can adapt here.
It's when you get to know how their current affairs is doing and how you can go about it different.
Very important, because I love the broad view of the whole international thing. If the elections are going on in the US, I'm so updated and detailed.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The mediators at the Khartoum talks have given more time to the warring parties to continue with negotiations until July 16th. Rajab Mohandas is a member of the civil society delegate at the talks. He says the extension is to allow the parties to discuss outstanding issues preventing the parties from reaching a deal. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
Mohandas says delegates at the IGAD-led peace talks were told last night to continue negotiating on the areas of disagreement.
The talks have been extended to next week until Monday. First is allow more time the mediation team and the parties to finalize the agreement on the transferment. And then the second is that Bashir was traveling this morning to Russia for the World Cup celebration. And so until he comes back, there will be no final decision on the final agreement.
A South Sudanese policy researcher at the talks confirms the parties have disagreed on the Entebbe power-sharing proposal. Alikaya Ligo Samson, who heads the concerned South Sudanese policy group, says mediators are working on the new document with suggestions from all the groups represented at the talks. Aligo says the Sudanese mediators are aware of concerns from all the parties and hopes to help resolve those concerns.
They wanted to know the critical areas, what are the reactions and the objections which have been given to them. And so we hope that they may be coming back with a reconciled document, because there is a lot of stress that they should build or try to see how they can draw the good points from the revised bridging gap and the first or the earlier document of Khartoum also before going to Entebbe, together with this one now.
Armed and unarmed opposition groups rejected the Entebbe power-sharing proposal presented by the Sudanese mediation team, with some parties complaining that the proposal favors the government. Aligo says the Entebbe proposal, if implemented, would give the government an advantage over the other parties during the transitional period.
Back to the earlier position of the government demanding a share of 70% or 80%. And then in Kampala, it became with a very big disparity if you compare the numbers of the distribution of the cabinet and the parliament, almost like the government is going with 80% power sharing, which is not acceptable or rejected by most of the opposition group and even the civil society.
He says mediators are just helping the parties to agree and that the final decision to end the conflict is with South Sudanese leaders.
It is we to work for peace more than any other person. The mediators are just facilitating guarantee venues for us and give us the technical support. All the South Sudanese, including the intellectuals and the political parties, must acknowledge that that is one of the tasks and responsibilities to bring peace. How much does it cost? We must make compromises to achieve peace and take our people back.
The Khartoum talks are now scheduled to end on Monday, after which the delegates may travel to Kenya to continue talking about the outstanding issues standing in the way of comprehensive peace deal for South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
Pro-government youth organizations and civil societies across the three regions of Barkazal, Upper Nile, and Equatoria met in Juba on Wednesday, a meeting organizers called the first National Consultative Conference. As Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba, the young South Sudanese are calling on the South Sudan government to focus on development during the transitional period.
The South Sudan National Youth Consortium, an umbrella of pro-government youth organizations, met under the theme, The Role of Youth in Peace and Nation Building. The leaders of the consortium formed last month say they want to give young South Sudanese an opportunity to discuss political issues affecting their demographic. Emmanuel Lobari, interim chairperson of the South Sudan National Youth Consortium, says people attending the conference discussed unemployment and the role of youth in peace building. He says young South Sudanese men and women must unite to defend their country against forces both inside and outside the country who want to tear South Sudan apart.
The youth should deliberate more on how to overcome the issues of unemployment, the involvement of youth in violence, you know, drug abuse, and so many forms of things that hinders, that affects the future of young people.
Lobari claims South Sudanese in the diaspora have been calling for regional intervention in South Sudan for some time in Kigali. He says he formed the consortium to counter voices from the diaspora tarnishing the image of South Sudan.
Some of the neighboring countries are frequently hosting South Sudanese youth activities antagonic to the constitution and the laws of the Republic of South Sudan. Therefore, in the interest of peace, we as the National Youth Consortium are urging those countries to halt such dangerous activities designed for regime change agenda.
Durai Ogur Deng is a member of the National Agenda, a pro-government political party based in Juba. He says young South Sudanese should avoid the politics of ethnicity when discussing national issues.
The upcoming constitution of South Sudan needs actually to have a provisions which actually discourage the regional and states and tribal association, because our president need to be informed by us that stop meeting communities.
Akileo Mboya Peter, who chairs a youth group in Kapweta State, says South Sudan needs peace so that young people can help develop the country.
There should be employment to the youth, because a country with a high rate of unemployment for the youth is very dangerous. That's why you find there are crimes everywhere. You know, youth, if you don't use them well, they become criminals. You see, if you use them well, they become heroes.
Some young South Sudanese accuse certain government officials of stealing money from the country's oil revenues and not being held accountable. Atem Duot Atem traveled from Upper Nile to attend the meeting in Juba. He says many young people in his region have lost what he calls the spirit of nationhood.
In Upper Nile, for instance, young people have been constantly believed and engaged in war for decades. Unless something extraordinary is done, these young people will grow up hostile and terribly bound.
South Sudan First Vice President Taban Deng Gai told young people attending the conference that the government will build tarmac roads across South Sudan.
We must move South Sudan forward. There are no roads in Bargazan, no roads in Greater Upper Nile, no roads even in Equatoria. There's this one single road, the one that comes from Juba, normally to Juba. We build that road through the support of our partners. It is warning out also. Wakalas Karab, Leder Siana. We need roads, and I agree with Rebecca, we need tarmac roads.
For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Aid agencies say more than 800,000 people displaced by violence in southern Ethiopia are facing a humanitarian crisis as the rainy season sets in, with inadequate shelter to protect them from cold, wet weather. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Hundreds of thousands of people were forced to flee their homes last month when intercommunal clashes broke out in southern Ethiopia's Gedeo and West Guji zones. The International Organization for Migration says people have walked for days to escape the fighting with nothing but the clothes on their back. It says many have been forced to sleep in the open along the way. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says many of the displaced are staying with relatives in local communities or in rented accommodations. Others are sheltering in schools, government buildings, and disused factories.
Thousands of people are crammed into overcrowded collective centers, unfit for human habitation. Others sleep outside on dirt floors with nothing more than a tarpaulin to shield them from the cold and rain. Open fire cooking and overly congested buildings, poor sanitation and cold weather are all contributing to a worsening environment from both health and protection perspectives.
Aid agencies report the displaced do not have enough food, clean water, shelter, and other basic necessities. They warn people will be at risk of malnutrition and disease outbreaks if humanitarian assistance is not scaled up. Millman says the IOM has distributed 1,000 blankets in the past week and is in the process of building 40 communal shelters and digging 150 latrines. The International Committee of the Red Cross says it, together with the Ethiopia Red Cross, will provide relief to 100,000 people. The agencies say they also will provide medicine and health supplies to local clinics. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Here's a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, Ian. The UN Security Council slapped an arms embargo on South Sudan nearly 5 years after the conflict began. The U.S.-drafted embargo is effective until May 2019. The resolution also places a travel ban and an asset freeze on current and former South Sudanese military officials Malik Ruben Riak and Paul Mulong Awan for expanding or extending the conflict. The resolution received 9 yes votes and 6 abstentions, including Ethiopia. South Sudan's ambassador to the UN tried to convince council members to vote against the measure, saying it would deter any progress made by mediators in the peace process. Casey Copeland, a senior researcher at the International Crisis Group, says the move is significant, but adds, quote, what it means on the ground is not clear yet. It depends on whether it is enforced and monitored and whether it actually stops the flow of weapons in and then what the effect of that is. And finally, about 500 women peacefully protested on the streets of Juba against the continued fighting. They say girls and women have borne the brunt of the suffering caused by the civil war. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, Carol. And that's our show for this Friday. We leave you with the song Hadia by Emmanuel Jal and Abdel Gadir Salim.
Listen to your heart, yo. You gotta listen to your soul. Yo, your spirit will direct you. You gotta know that. For all of yende laji, ye kwa yende, you could do. Robungo, I show you for lobby, nang and yin to yaja. Nang and robungo, and yen, kong me, yen, lord engine.
We've been listening to Emmanuel Jal and Abdel Gadir Salim with the song Hadia. I'm Ayan Deng Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
¶¶
alena mama yaya alak ahli alma kibru balwaya arret kan samo ane ani sharaya